Robin for that introduction. So this is some work I'm doing with Manny Canil, Thomas Garrett, Tracy Clement, Marty Stevens, Sam Nam, and Rich Mirren. All of us are at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, in Boulder, Colorado. And well, we're just a fledgling quantum optics group that started a few years ago without a lot of experience in these kinds of experiments. So we're just getting up to speed. So please be nice to us. So here's a little outline of what I will talk about. So I should tell you that this is going to be a description of an experiment that isn't really working yet, and a discussion of some theoretical ideas that might be of assistance to the experiment, but they're not completely thought out yet. So Robin said, tell me what you're working on, what you're interested in. And so this is something I'm actually still working on right now. And Robin also said that he wanted talks that were bold and daring. So I believe that it is bold and daring for a scientist to stand and admit his ignorance. So I'm glad we had already one healthy precedent for that today. So I'm going to talk about what I'm calling the multimode squeezing problem. That is basically a problem that when you make squeezed light, there are usually generated squeezed light in several modes at the same time. And so I'm talking here about temporal or spectral modes, not the transverse modes that are created at different angles coming out of the squeezing crystal, but overlapping temporal or spectral modes. These are problematic for using the squeeze light in some QIP type applications, particularly our photon subtraction experiment. So I will talk about what's happening in that experiment and what we think the influence of the extra squeeze modes are. And then I will talk a little about our ideas for how to do a kind of tomography of all of these modes of squeezing. So first, we'll start off with just a brief description of what is going on in the squeezing process. So I'm going to describe here a case that is only discussing pure light, and it's really only in a kind of weak squeezing limit, where we're only thinking of generating zero or two photons. But everything I say carries on to more general case, and if you want to know more about that, you should read this paper. So in the squeezing experiment, we have a pump light, and it's a pulse, so we might imagine it has a Gaussian shape. And it comes into some nonlinear crystal, and it makes two photons, and the photons' frequencies are omega and omega prime. And there's some joint spectral wave function thing, psi, which is a function of the two frequencies. And it describes the probability amplitudes for creating a frequency with omega and a frequency omega prime. So mostly you make vacuum, and with some probability, you're going to make these two photons. And right now, I'm writing these creation operators as creating a photon with particular frequency omega or omega prime. So the shape of the psi is determined by broadband energy conservation conditions and phase matching in the crystal. So if you look at a graph in the omega and omega prime space, there are a couple of constraints on psi or influences on it. The first is this condition that the sum frequency of the two photons must be equal to the pump frequency. But because there is broadband spectrum in the pump, it's not confined to being exactly on this line, but some distance here. Also, there is another condition of momentum conservation, which makes a curve shape like this. But it is not exactly constraining either, so there is this distance here. In this paper, they discuss at some length the Gaussian approximation of this. So they draw this Gaussian shape here. But you may, in more general thinking, realize that it's going to make a kind of banana shape here at the ends. So if the squeezing is degenerate, that is the the two photons it makes are indistinguishable. This wave function psi should be symmetric. And we can use an orthonormal decomposition of the modes into what we will call characteristic modes, psi sub n. So you can just write this as some sum over these modes. And we can define new creation and annihilation operators, which create or annihilate photons in the characteristic modes. So when we do that, we can write the state of the system as some fraction of the vacuum plus some fraction of creating two photons in mode n. Then we have a sum over all of these. So there's some probability of creating two photons in mode 1, 2, 3, and so on. So I should emphasize that for each of these modes, they're squeezed independently. There's not entanglement between them. And for weak squeezing, each one of these is approximately a Gaussian Hermite polynomial, which you recognize as the harmonic oscillator position wave functions. However, for strong squeezing, they will not necessarily be such nice looking things, but some other orthonormal set we can always find. If you want to create squeezing in only one mode, well, we need some kind of reassurance that in this sum, there's only one term represented. This may be possible by doing some kind of clever engineering of the crystal dispersion properties and the pump shape, pump bandwidth, of these kinds of things. Some people have looked at these things, Grice-Urin and Walmsley. They are recommending that you can use degenerate type 2 down conversion and BBO with 800 nanometer pump. And they show one of these wave functions, and it looks symmetric, which is what we like to see. And they are showing here the weight of the different terms in this sum, and we get strong weight on one of them and weak on others. So in this prototypical squeezing experiment, we will use homodyne detection to measure our squeeze light. And so we want to know how will all of these modes affect the result of homodyne detection. So we take our pump and we make blue light, and then we down convert, making the squeeze light here. And this is used for a local oscillator. And we have here all of these modes on top of one another. The local oscillator, we'll say, is in shape phi of omega. That's its pulse shape. And it overlaps with each one of these modes by this integral, which we could just call a sub n, or we can write the real and complex parts. So we measure here, and each run of the experiment, each pulse, we measure some homodyne signal. And in general, it is going to be this linear combination of the x and p quadratures for each of the modes summed together. If we vary the phase of this, it will change this angle alpha here. And so we will get x or p measurements out of our homodyne detection. You can also think about, well, what suppose there's only one mode squeezed and all the others have vacuum. Then you would just get the usual kind of relationship here where you've got a mixture of vacuum and the squeezed light that you usually see for lossy homodyne detection. The variances of our measurement we can write this way, where we just have the squares of these. Here, there's maybe a slightly more clever way to write all of this, which is we have a vector that describes the overlap when each element's got the real and imaginary parts. So the vector's length is twice the number of modes that we are interested in. And Q is a quadrature vector, so it's got X and P in each element. And we can transform the quadratures we measure and the variance. So we want to know what's the variance of this signal that we're measuring here. It's just the product of A transpose VA, where A is this matrix which has only got stuff on the diagonal. And each element on the diagonal is the variance of each quadrature. We assume it does because they are characteristically squeezed modes. If they have non-diagonal stuff, that would mean the modes are entangled with one another.
And it's, do you sort of verify that they're not, or is this just an assumption that goes into the model?
Yeah, this is an assumption about the stuff that I said a page ago, where we can write each of these modes as if they're not entangled with one another.
Okay, and that relies on saying the squeezing is degenerate.
Yeah. So I should make a couple of important comments. So because each mode has different levels of squeezing, the state observed in the homodyne detection cannot be a minimum uncertainty state or pure state. That is, unless the local oscillator shape exactly matches one of the modes. If that is the case, then we have only one of these terms represented. And if the squeeze light you made was pure, the squeeze light you measured would be pure. So to measure strong squeezing or pure squeezing, you should try to shape the local oscillator to match one of the squeezed modes, the most squeezed one, ideally. And this is usually done by finding some Gaussian shape that gives you the best measurements. But I want to point out this shape that you need is not necessarily a Gaussian. So the extra modes present several problems for quantum information processing tasks. They've got a bunch of unwanted photons in them. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt again. So you're assuming, you said that the shape is not necessarily Gaussian. Was it important in the previous slide that it seemed like we were assuming Gaussian? So we had the vector and the variances.
No. So there's multiple Gaussian types of things happening. The first Gaussian thing is the shape of this. And the second, an entirely different Gaussian thing, is the quantum states that occupy each mode. So we are assuming that the quadrature states in each mode are Gaussian quantum states. But the shape of the mode, which is an entirely different thing, can be whatever.
Okay.
So these extra photons cause no trouble if all of your experiment has in it linear optics and homodyne detection. So homodyne detection is only sensitive to the contents of the mode that is exactly matched to the local oscillator. So you can ignore the extra things if all you do are linear optics and homodyne detection. Of course, many of the interesting quantum information processing tasks, we want to go outside of that regime. For example, if you want to do something with a nonlinear medium, such as Kerr effect, or interacting the squeeze light with some atoms, you have to worry that the photons in the mode that's not matched to the local oscillator will interact with your atom or your Kerr effect. If you are thinking of doing some kind of cryptography with your squeeze light in the prepare and send and measure type of cryptography, these extra modes might be observable by eavesdroppers. The extra photons in the modes will make photon detectors click. And so this is a big problem that I'm going to talk a lot more about now. So this here is the photon subtraction experiment. It is basically a method to make superpositions of coherent states, which is just alpha plus or minus alpha. These are two coherent states. And people often call this a cat state. And I'll probably do the same. So the idea is you just make squeeze light like our previous experiment, except we stick in a little beam splitter here that moves some light up into a photon detector. And when the detector says click, then we believe that a cat state occupies this beam here. And we will do the usual homodyne detection on our cat state to verify that it was created when the detector said click. Just for a reference, I copied a Wigner function for the ideally photon subtracted state and the perfect cat state for alpha 0.8.
So you have my... This is a one mode cat state, right? Plus minus alpha?
Yeah.
So shouldn't the Wigner function be like blob, blob, and interference fringes?
Yeah, right? It is for much larger.
Okay, so it's alpha. All squished in.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so this is this, I think in this publication they call it kitten state. So this has been done already by this other very wonderful experiment of Grangier's group a couple of years ago. Here's the Wigner function they found, which is very nice looking. They say they have a fidelity of about 70% with the closest perfect cat state, and their alpha is 0.79, alpha squared, that's mean number of photons, 0.79. So in the experiment, they say in their paper that they put in some filters here. And clearly, the purpose of these filters is to reject unwanted modes, or probably one of the purposes of the filters is to reject the unwanted modes and hopefully accept photons from the desired mode. They write in their description that they want to guess or estimate this parameter they call the modal purity, which is the probability that a click in the detector was caused by a photon from the mode that matched the local oscillator and not one other mode or a dark count or some other thing. And they say that probability was about 0.82. So that clearly counts for a quite large portion of their infidelity, because if you this the state of that is produced when you trigger on the wrong number of photons hitting your detector is orthogonal to the desired state. So I also want to say here that their filters clearly can't do a really great job of what they want to do, because if you're just going to filter out some frequency band, well, there's no clear space here where you're going to get a lot of this Gaussian that you want, but not the next Hermite polynomials, because they are all that. Well, I drew a tangled mess because that's what they are. Since we're just trying to learn how to do quantum optics experiments, we want to do Grangier's experiment again ourselves. But we want to do one extra thing, is now we will trigger on 2 or 3 or maybe 4. We want to trigger on detecting a larger number of photons here. So we hope we can do this because we have these nice detectors, superconducting, transition edge sensitive photon number resolving. They've got this high efficiency. Their dark counts are very low. They seem to be limited only by whatever black body radiation happens to get into them. And they can count reliably numbers of photons. Yeah?
That the detectors, the ones we're using are very high efficiency, but the ones that they're using, And so obviously, when they get a click, they don't actually know whether it was one photon or two photons or whatever. Has that been included in the model when you're trying to work out what state is coming out after the detector? For example, I mean, could that account also for a large part of the the infidelity with the expected state?
Yeah, that has been accounted for, and the answer is no, that cannot account for very much of the fidelity. The problem is that, or the reason is that, you squeeze not very strongly. So the probability that there were extra photons is very low. And yeah, the fidelity will go down roughly by a factor which is proportional to that number of photons.
Okay. But because you've got a very weak coherent squeezed vacuum to start with, then those higher order terms don't play much of a role.
Yeah. And I should also point out that it's for the fidelity of the state, it's really not important that the efficiency of the detector be very high, because it doesn't really hurt you very much, because there's such a low probability that too many photons came.
But if you're starting to detect on getting a click two, for example, the same argument is that the higher order terms still have much lower probability.
Yeah.
Any idea what sort of size? Are we talking a few percent or 10% or like 0.5%?
Well, there are lots of things here that in this experiment, that parameters that you can adjust. And it turns out that the highest fidelity cat you can make is made in the limit of infinitesimally small squeezing and detecting infinitely large numbers of photons here. and the efficiency of this detector doesn't even matter. I don't know if that was exactly an answer, but if not, you can rephrase your question.
I guess if you're looking at a specific case, if you detect two photons, or even if you're just detecting one photon and you see a click, then what size of the error comes? I mean, in our experiments, we have to deal with the higher order terms that they actually do make a noticeable thing. Not big, but we're talking a few percent. Are you thinking the same size here?
Yeah, a few percent is reasonable. Okay. So here are just some comments on preliminary results. So we have done the experiment of just subtracting a single photon. And this is the Wigner function that we reconstruct from that. The fidelity is low. We think around 60%. But that's partly because we just haven't done enough work to maximize the purity of the squeeze state by matching it with the local oscillator and removing other sorts of losses. But it's also clearly caused significantly by this problem of too many photons and extra modes not matched to the local oscillator. And we have verified this by comparing the squeezing signal that we get from Homodyne. So we can take the signal we get from the Homodyne detection, and we know the mean number of photons that should be present in that squeezed state, provided assuming that that was the only squeeze state present. And so we can compare that to photon counting rate. We just put a photon detector in the path of this beam containing many modes. We get lots too many photons. So what we really want is two things. One, make the squeezing in only one mode. So we're working on that too. But I will talk to you today about this. We want to measure the contents, that is the amount of squeezing in each of the modes, and we want to have some method to measure the shape of the extra modes that are made in the squeezing process. So we're calling this method a Gaussian multimode tomography. We want a method to measure these characteristic modes, shapes psi sub n omega, and the squeezing zeta sub n for each of them, 1 to n. And you know, we don't a priori know the largest number here. We just have to do some experiments and figure out where to truncate this thing. So obviously, full quantum state tomography for all of these on the order of 50 or so, maybe, harmonic oscillators is totally impractical. So what we will do is restrict ourselves only to Gaussian states. So the Gaussian states include vacuum state, anything you might do to the vacuum state with Hamiltonians that are quadratic in the mode operators. So that's squeezing, beam splitters, displacement, Homodyne detection, all of those things. Will keep you inside the family of Gaussian states. Here, I'm only going to talk about Gaussian states centered at the origin. That's basically because adding in the means of all of these things to the equations just make them look ugly, and they're not particularly interesting. But I don't see any reason why having Gaussian states centered elsewhere than the origin is problematic for us. So these Gaussian states, we can write their Wigner function in this way. Where Q is a vector that contains each quadrature variable, and sigma is a covariance matrix. So here, Robin, we're thinking of general covariance matrix that will have off-diagonal terms. I should say a few things about what are the properties of this guy. It should be real. It should be symmetric. It should be positive definite, and so it should have positive eigenvalues. So those are properties of all covariance matrices. For any things that have Gaussian statistics. The quantum states have an extra constraint, which is that they should obey the uncertainty principle, which is a statement that says something about the variances of pairs of modes, or the variances of the quadratures in each mode. So that is about pairs of rows of our covariance matrix. And it's quite a complicated proof. But if you read this paper, which has many wonderful things to say about Gaussian states, they demonstrate that this uncertainty principle constraint is equivalent to the statement that the covariance matrix plus this factor here must be positive semi-definite. And Q is just a block diagonal matrix with 1 and minus 1 on the off-diagonal terms, which come from commutators, actually. All the Gaussian state transformations make symplectic group when they are transforming the covariance matrix. And passive linear optical transformations are slightly more restricted because they must be in the orthogonal group. And generally, diagonalization of a covariance matrix requires everything in the orthogonal group, but our passive linear optical transformations don't include all of those things. So you can try to remember that for later. So our idea is that we're just going to choose some set of modes. I'll call this our modes, beta sub n, which we just choose for convenience. They may as well be the Gaussian Hermite polynomials. And they each have some overlap with the characteristic modes given by these integrals. And we can write, we can transform from the diagonal covariance matrix for the characteristic modes into the covariance matrix for our modes using this matrix transformation, where this matrix contains real and imaginary parts of each of these guys.
Analyzing using SO2N. Aren't some of those, so some of the SO2N transformations are non-physical, right? Like the ones that rotate X1 into P2 and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you diagonalize, do you want to allow those or do you want to only use the intersection of those with the ones that are also symplectic?
Well, I'm not sure about that. That's a question that I want hope maybe someone else can answer, or I will have some insight. So the scheme is just to break this problem now into two parts. First, we're going to find the covariance matrix for our set of modes. And we expect that to be entangled. They used to be entangled with one another, because they are essentially beam splitter transformations of the characteristic modes. Then, once we do that, we want to have some way to diagonalize the matrix that we infer, sigma, to find the shapes of the characteristic modes. If we can diagonalize this, then we can transform these into the characteristics. Okay, so the measurement scheme will work like this. It's just an adaptation of homodyne detection with a few pieces added. The first is a pulse shaper or something like this. The goal of that is to make the local oscillator shape as skinny as possible so that it can gather some of this structure of this tangled mess here. Second, we're going to add a long time delay, much longer than is usually used in homodyne detection. In homodyne detection, you only want to map out 2π worth of angle. But we need to map this thing over the entire distance of this, of these pulses. So, and at each of the time delays, we're going to measure the signal here, and we'll call that xi. So there will be some overlap, of course, between our local oscillator and our modes given by this integral. And we can control that overlap somewhat by varying the time delay. And if we are even more industrious, we may be able to vary even more by changing the shapes of the pulse. Oh, 3 minutes? That's 2 minutes. I'll never get back. So for each of these time delays or shapes or whatever, each of these measurement conditions I, the variance that we will measure, well, the variable that we will measure here is some Gaussian random variable. And it's got a variance. This is now a scalar, which because it's got this vector transpose sigma and this overlap vector here. So now we have a forward probability model for this whole system. We can say that the probability to measure our whole collection of data is just the products of like sampling from single variable Gaussian distributions, where at each sampling, the variance changes a little bit according to this here. And we should know how much the variance changes because we know these two vectors, or we know this vector C. So we can look at the log likelihood function for this thing, which is that, but it is kind of a mess, and it's not obvious to us how to. Yeah. Thanks. So we'll use convex optimization of sigma. Oh, you should teach me more about this. I only started to learn statistics about a month ago when I ran into this problem, and I thought, surely someone has already solved this, but I hadn't yet found a convincing solution. So once that part of the problem is done, we've got some estimate of sigma. We want to use that to find the set of characteristic modes. And these, by squeezing theory, should have a diagonal covariance matrix. However, the matrix we have inferred is noisy. And it's not clear, to me at least, how to find the matrices or matrix B to use to diagonalize this. Because we want to limit this to things which can be done by linear optics. Because by theory, the characteristic modes have some linear optical transformation that maps them into the modes we have chosen, the modes beta that I was talking about. Anyway, if we can do this finding, this matrix B, which inverts this or diagonalizes the sigma, then we can use that to find the characteristic modes as sums over our mode decomposition. Yes? Yeah.
It's called symplectic diagonalization. There's a paper by a couple of Italian guys. I can't remember the names right off. But it actually, so to diagonalize with SP2N instead of SO2N, it turns out to be enough to multiply your matrix on the left by that J matrix with the off diagonal ones and minus ones, or I guess just ones, and then do regular diagonalization. Turns out to be the answer.
Great.
I'm getting a lot of work done.
So here are just some concluding remarks. Pulse squeezing makes many temporal modes. The extra modes are troublesome for photon subtraction experiment like ours, and will be troublesome for other quantum information processing applications. We want to reduce the occupation of the extra modes, and we want to use our homodyne detection system to do this multimode Gaussian tomography to verify that there are a few photons in the extra modes. And we also have an extra credit problem, which is design the device that can do this, take these mini modes and filter out the extra ones and transmit only the one that we like. That's the end.
So we have about 10 minutes left for questions. I think the first hand was far back.
So I'm a bit confused. What you measure is a bunch of squeezing matrices. You don't measure covariance matrices.
What do you mean, squeezing matrix?
Well, on each temporal mode, you do, well, say you do tomorrow. Yeah, no, you don't do tomorrow. Suppose you do tomorrow. Then you characterize the squeezing in this particular mode, but you don't know any correlation between different temporal modes. And isn't that the information you would need to achieve your goal?
Right, and in a particular measurement, we get information about the off-diagonal elements of sigma because they are each represented somewhere in this sum that is produced when you multiply these together. So this product gives you information about the off-diagonal terms of this sigma.
How many modes do you need to characterize? Say you want to know the covariance matrix for say 10 modes. How many squeezing and how many modes do you need to measure?
But if you are, I'm not sure if you know that there are exactly 10 squeezed modes represented up here, then you only need to do your reconstruction with 10 modes. But maybe that's not really what you're asking.
I'm saying, suppose there are 10 squeezing eigenmodes.
Yeah.
The modes in which you measure are not eigenmodes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So how many modes do you need to measure?
I don't know.
But much more than 10, right?
Yeah, I mean, you need to measure enough so that you get good, faithful representation of each of those 10 modes projected onto the modes that we choose to do our decomposition. So we need to choose the modes in our decomposition so that they do a good job of sampling from the eigenmodes of the squeezing process.
Yes?
You didn't say anything about angular modes, I understood, yeah. But in experiment, you have to deal with multimode angular spectrum. So do you have any ideas about what to do?
So, well, for one thing, it's relatively easy, I think, to get rid of those by just putting your light into a single mode fiber. I think it's easier to sort of filter out those extra angular modes than it is to filter out these from your experiment. But if you're asking me, do I know how to characterize that using some system, a relatively simple system like this? No, I don't.
Well, I think here you could say you're going to filter out the frequency modes as well, but then you would spoil the squeezing matrix. So
yeah.
I think it's not a good solution to put a fiber and to filter out angular modes.
No, because you will get lost.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Scott again.